So, as I said previously, Dr. Ralph Katz is not available to come here, but he should be able to talk to us on the phone. Hello, Ralph. This is Wu Song.
Ah, hello.
Hi. We're all ready, and then we're in the session right now. You have 15 minutes for us to present our slides. Okay, I'll put you on the speaker. Oh, yes, title slide is up right now.
Thank you. Well, first, I'm very pleased to be able to present at this wonderful symposium that some very thoughtful, insightful people decided to put on about all the energy and activities of these health disparity centers supported by NIDCR over the past 7 years. I look to present major findings from the NYU Oral Cancer RAP Center. That's the research on adolescent and adult health promotion. I'd like to point out that I am deeply indebted to my working colleague for the past 7 years, Ms. Emily Gottfried, who's been our research administrator and has had a hand on most of the things that have been successful within the center. The very fact of presenting today is totally unexpected given circumstances of my health, and I am truly appreciative and think it's incredibly thoughtful that the moderators for this session, Wu Sung San and Ruth Najak Rama, with the assistance of Jane Weintraub, figured out how to let this happen, and I appreciate that. Next slide, please.
Okay.
Disclosure slide says that my name is Ralph Katz and I have no financial relationships to disclose. But talking about disclosures from the past, here's a bit of history, because history does matter. Quote, NIDCR was the first among the individual institutes that comprised the NIH to establish a research agenda and a functioning program to address issues of minority health via research centers for minority health initiated in 1992. It set in motion forces of societal impact that went well beyond whatever scientific goals NIDCR envisioned at that time, including both the occurrence of the presidential apology for the Tuskegee syphilis study and the establishment of the National Center for Bioethics in Research and Healthcare at Tuskegee University that came out of that apology. The maxim for centers is that the whole should be greater than the sum of its initial constituent studies or parts. NIDCR continued its institutional commitment to supporting this line of investigation, initiated in 1991, by funding 5 centers for research to reduce oral health disparities in 2001, and most recently just concluded funding a second round of oral health disparities centers. My hats off to NIDCR for its commitment to this line of research. Our center, and this is an overview slide of the center, has several components. I can point out the major pieces to you, and then I'll tell you some findings from within. First, we have in the middle of it 4 major projects that were done, and these are supported at the top by 3 cores, an administrative core, a biostatistics core, and an informatics core. We also did some pilot studies and had training at the master's in clinical research level, at the PhD in epidemiology level, and even short-term 1335 training grant for minorities dental students from a couple of institutions around the country. Next slide, please.
Yes.
The publications that have come out of our center, both manuscripts and abstracts, reflect the activity we've had and the success we've had scientifically. We've had 61 publications in the manuscript area to date, 29 of which have come directly from RAP Center studies. Another 26 are actually in progress from RAP Center studies. And the abstracts total 70 to date, 60 of those coming directly from RAP Center funded studies, 17 others from other health disparities abstracts from people involved with the RAP Center. Next slide, please.
Yeah.
All of these can be found on our NYU website. Just Google NYU College of Dentistry, hit the button that says research, hit the button that says RAP, and you will find yourself in with a selection of all these publications manuscripts and abstracts. Next slide, please. Let me turn then to some of the highlights that come from our NYU Oral Cancer Web Center. Next slide. First thing I'd point out is we had an unusual configuration amongst the working centers, but probably something in line with the future that research will have, in that it's going to be not only multidisciplinary, but multi-center. As you can see from the collaborating institutions, we have 15 to 17 different universities at the School of Public Health, medical school, or dental school, or health agencies in an area working together at any one time. Therefore, we needed an informatics core under the steady hand of Dr. Titus Schlayer from University of Pittsburgh to help keep us in communication across our multiple sites. I would also point out that following up on relationship we had with the Tuskegee University's National Bioethics Center for Research in Healthcare, we helped them initiate the research agenda and use some of our money to fund a collaborative set of pilot studies for a four-year period on cancer bioethical issues. Next slide, please. So let me turn to some of the major studies and give you some of the findings we have to date. Next slide, please. Major project one is called Epidemiologic and Genetic Risk Factors for Oral Epithelial Dysplasia, OED, and the PI is Doug Morse from the NYU College of Dentistry. Next slide. When we began this project back in 2001, at about that time, it was recognized that males in Puerto Rico have the highest age-adjusted incidence rates for oral cancer in the Western Hemisphere. Next slide, please. Therefore, we planned to investigate this issue in Puerto Rico, and Doug Moore set up a study to estimate the independent association between oral epithelial dysplasia, and later included oral cancer, and smoking and drinking in a primarily Hispanic population. Next slide, please. To do this, he set up an island-wide system that collected incident cases of oral epithelial dysplasia and or oral cancer from all the pathology laboratories on the island. He set up a case control study that primarily was investigating smoking tobacco and drinking as the independent variables, but also considered mouthwash, smokeless tobacco, dentures, diet, and then genetic polymorphisms as well. Next slide, please. But on the way to pursuing that answer, Puerto Rico, a funny thing happened on the way to the findings. Some things got noticed. Next slide, please. It's generally agreed oral lesions suspicious for cancer or precancer should be biopsied, and if that happens, precancerous benign diagnoses would predominate any pathology data set. Next slide, please. So if all lesions suspicious for oral cancer are being biopsied, one would expect to see more biopsies diagnosed with dysplasia, endohyperkeratosis, or epithelial hyperplasia relative to cancers. Next slide. But that's not what was seen island-wide in the Puerto Rican pathology laboratories. Next slide, please. So a pilot study was undertaken based on what was being noticed, if you will, to study it more formally. And Doug Moore started a project to formally evaluate this very factor. Next slide, please. And these three pie diagrams represent the whole pie being people who were biopsied and diagnosed in Puerto Rico on the left, in Bellevue, a big city hospital in New York City, and coming out of the New York NYU College of Dentistry Dental Clinics and Educational Institution. In Puerto Rico, the dark part of that circle of 69% means that almost 70% of all biopsies across Puerto Rico were oral cancer, as compared to, at the NYU College of Dentistry, only 5% of the biopsies coming out were oral cancer, and even at a big city hospital like Bellevue, 43% was as high as it got for oral cancer as a proportion of all biopsies and diagnoses. And these were all statistically different from each other. The conclusion, next slide please. In Puerto Rico, relative to the U.S., persons with intraoral lesions suspicious for oral cancer or precancer are more likely to go unbiopsied until they have an invasive cancer. And this appears to be an important disparity in very early oral cancer detection in Puerto Rico relative to the U.S. mainland. The overall major study, next slide please, for this risk factors for OED in Puerto Rico, has now completed its case collection, 350 cases. They've completed all 2-hour behavioral interviews with all identified cases, and they're just finished a qualitative inquiry based on other things they noticed on the way to the findings. Looking at now the oral cancer diagnosis habits of patients and dentists, the knowledge, attitudes, and practice, trying to find out what's leading to this very late diagnosis and reluctance to biopsy early. That concludes that study. The next study I turn to is one that was a randomized clinical trial on smoking cessation that was run on the dental clinics of our college. Next slide, please. The smoking cessation randomized clinical trial had 3 arms: personalized risk feedback versus motivational counseling sessions versus standard of care. Next slide, please. This is graphically laid out in this slide. The standard of care was a full and rich packet of handout information given to patients about smoking cessation. Standard of care plus motivational counseling was the second arm in the middle, and it included a 45-minute motivational counseling session, and then at 2 weeks, telephone counseling, and at 1 month, telephone counseling again. The third arm included both the standard of care packet, motivational counseling, and personalized risk feedback, which included 2 personalized feedback instruments for the patient. They got a detailed oral exam of any damage done by smoking to their mouth, and they got a alveolar carbon monoxide measure given to them as feedback on the level that they had, plus all the other elements. Interestingly, at the end of a 12-month follow-up, you can see with the continuous abstinence that there was no significant difference at all between the 3 arms. 18% of standard care ceased smoking, 20% and 24% of the 2 other arms. The line at the bottom gives another interesting statistic, that these subjects in this study averaged 18 cigarettes per day over a mean of 17 years at entry into the study. At the end, the line above it shows that they were reduced by about 40% to 11 cigarettes or 10 cigarettes a day, which would certainly make a difference in health outcomes. So while the personalized risk factor didn't turn out to be technique that showed a difference over the standard time you spend with your patient counseling, there's very good news here for dentists who are interested in health promotion. A patient who stayed in the study for 12 months on standard of care, 18%, like nearly 20% quit, and 60% reduced number of cigarettes a day, from 18 to 11 cigarettes a day. That's quite an accomplishment for minimum time devoted, and over a several-year period will certainly have an impact on a large percent of smoking patients who are ready to quit. The other study that we'll present today is a study that was done on cancer screening and research participation by minorities. This study was called the Cancer Screening and Research Participation by Minorities. It began with the idea put in place many years ago that there is this Tuskegee legacy, that is, that as a result of the Tuskegee syphilis study, African-Americans were less willing to participate in biomedical research. This was presented as a key topic at a 1994 bioethics conference at the University of Virginia, which was the origins of this line of investigation. At the time, we had the Minority Oral Health Research Center and started a pilot study into this. Next slide, please. For those who are not intimately familiar with the U.S. Public Health Service Tuskegee Syphilis Study, it was run by U.S. Public Health Service doctors for a 40-year period. It studied the effects of untreated syphilis in the Negro male. It followed almost 400 Black sharecroppers to their deaths or 1972 when the study was terminated. It denied subjects penicillin in World War II. President Clinton issued an apology to the African American community in 1994. It stands, unfortunately, as the most infamous U.S. research abuse study in history. Next slide, please. So the 2 big questions that we look to take on with this project: are Blacks more reluctant to participate as research subjects in biomedical studies? And then, does awareness of the Tuskegee syphilis study lead to reluctance to participate in biomedical studies? I'll point out we did a first study, a four-city study, which included Hartford, Connecticut, Birmingham, Alabama, Tuskegee, Alabama, and San Antonio in 1999-2000. And for the sake of time, to keep this on time, I'm going to skip ahead to a couple of slides. And if you'll go down to the slide that has two big no's in it, you find that slide?
Which one?
So the two big no's. So the answer to the two big key questions from the four-city TLP study. Are blacks more reluctant to participate in research ethics in biomedical studies? We have clear data that the answer is no. And we have clear data that awareness of a Tuskegee syphilis study lead to reluctance to participate in biomedical studies? No. This study, the four-city study, has the same questions backed up by a repeated study done in 2003 in the Disparity Center that we had at NYU in the cities of New York, Baltimore, and San Juan, the same answers, so we've confirmed both those studies. I point out that this is now based on almost 2,300 subjects in seven U.S. cities in two separate surveys, and then this headline probably captures it, research participation, blacks equally willing but more wary as measured by our guinea pig fear factor scale. What's the significance of these findings at this point? Well, first of all, I think it gives, next slide, please. It gives key information that's related to NIH mandate to study diverse populations as required by NIH guidelines since 1994. And despite the horrors of the Tuskegee syphilis study abuses, the rumored legacy of the Tuskegee syphilis study per se is not an issue to overcome and hence not insurmountable. Nevertheless, the third point I'd make is lower trust levels, guinea pig fear, wariness, and lower a history of lower rate of participation amongst African Americans says active plans put into action are needed to achieve inclusion of diverse populations. And there are studies now coming out in the showing that major national studies that have undertaken this third point, put active plans into action, have achieved equal, if not higher, recruitment goals in minority populations. I conclude my presentation by this cartoon, which is up, which says, and it was so typically brilliant of you to have invited an epidemiologist. I would point out that this epidemiologist is most thankful to the good efforts of Wu Sung Song and Ruth Dowjack Raymer for letting me have this opportunity to present despite my absence from the meeting. And I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Chef. Okay, before you go, if anybody has questions to Dr. Katz.
Has your last study been published yet?
The question is, has your last study published yet?
We have, yes. The answer is yes. We have seven publications that are out already. One is coming out this November in the Journal of Healthcare for the Poor and Underserved, looking at the legacy question. We have another one coming out in February that backs that up in the National Journal of the National Medical Association. And so we have a series of studies. And if you go to the website, NYU, Google Research, Google RAP, you will find these studies all there.